Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of the Kitch Niche. My name is Strike, and we are going to do something a little different tonight that we've never done before on this show. I'm dedicating the entire first hour of the Kitch Niche to an interview I did with Dana Countryman. If you're not familiar with Dana Countryman, he is a Moog impresario, a collaborator of Jean-Jacques Paré, and the publisher of the now-defunct Cool and Strange magazine. Cool and Strange Music magazine, rather. So we're going to take the whole first hour of the Kitch Niche for this interview. There are five segments. Each one's about 10 minutes long. Between segments, I am going to come on the air and give away copies of the brand new CD Moog-tastic, which is the centerpiece of this interview tonight. So here's what you do in preparation. You go to Facebook and you get onto Strike Kitch Niche. That's my Kitch Niche show page. It's Strike Kitch Niche. K-I-T-C... I can't even spell my own show! K-I-T-S-C-H-N-I-C-H-E. And what you're going to do is, once I give you a trivia question, you're going to message me your answer. We'll talk about that a little bit more as we get into the program tonight. So without further ado, here is the first segment of my very interesting interview with Mr. Moog himself, Dana Countryman. Enjoy it. Dana Countryman, welcome to the Kitch Niche. It's
nice. Thanks, Strike. Thanks for having me.
We're pleased to have you on. I've been a fan for a long time, and I'll explain why in just a few minutes. But before I do that, what I'd like to do is I would like to play the opening track from your brand new CD, which is entitled Moog-tastic, Electronic Melodies from the 24th Century, out on Oglio Records. And this is called Lovesick Martian Boy.
Bye. So I want to ask you a few questions about the opening track. I mean, this is classic Moog pop style. You know, it's it's almost like a robot talking from outer space, which is when I think of the Moog, that's really how I like to think about it. I don't like to think about it in the way that Emerson, Lake, and Palmer used it.
Exactly.
It's such a joyful instrument and makes such happy sounds that I've always preferred the pop style. And plus the opening track really shows off the capabilities of the machine. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the composing of the song. Did you approach it musically originally, or did you have a technical plan in mind that led to a musical riff?
Well, as you know, I'm a big fan of Jean-Jacques Perret, and we'll probably talk about this, but I did work with him more recently. And I remember I listened to that album, The In Sound from Way Out, and I thought, man, it'd be kind of neat to write a tune kind of along those lines, you know, that kind of has that kind of wistful, kind of playful quality. And it kind of just simmered in the back of my brain. I do remember that it was a Saturday morning, and I was actually getting out of the shower, and I got the idea for that tune while I was dripping wet, and I stepped out of the shower and somehow went, and so I basically ran downstairs and probably sang into a cassette recorder or something. But I did want to, the idea of that tune was to try and recreate that kind of very innocent 60s style of George Jetson cartoon, that kind of fun Moog sound like you just described, because I was totally charmed by that when I first heard these Moog synthesizer albums come out. And I like the wacky sounds, and I'm with you. I have nothing against Keith Emerson, but I'm just not into the progressive rock thing. I'm into the kind of goofball, cartoony stuff, and I think it probably shows, you know, which is why I was attracted to Jean-Jacques' music.
And at what point in your life did you discover that? How old were you?
I was 16 years old when a friend and I actually discovered Jean-Jacques' music together. They had been using a tune of his called Computer in Love on a local TV show. And we were so intrigued by what that song was that we called the station, and we were able to get through to the sound engineer. And he said, yeah, it's by this French composer named Jean-Jacques Perret. So I was still in high school, and I used to drag Jean-Jacques' albums with me into my French class. I remember very clearly sneaking them in a paper bag. And I would stare at these things and just be amazed by the liner notes and pictures of synthesizers. I used to draw pictures of synthesizers in class and daydream about someday owning one. And, hey, my dream came true.
So for all us lay people, kind of explain in the simplest of terms how a Moog synthesizer works. Now, as my understanding is, you can only create one note at a time. Is that correct? Or one sound at a time?
Yeah, you only can get one sound at a time. It's a monophonic instrument. But, you know, it's no different than a saxophone or a flute or one of those other kinds of instruments. So if you think of it in that term, even though it has a big keyboard, looks like a piano, you do only get one sound at a time. And people like Wendy Carlos, well, and Jean-Jacques for that matter too, you know, they would do all this multi-tracking where they would put one part specifically on one track and then play along with that and get another part. And so eventually you get enough parts, it sounds like an entire orchestra and chords. And I definitely do things that way myself, although I do use the computer as a tool also. So the computer and the synthesizer kind of work together in this modern day. So that's what they didn't have back in those days. And that's why they did a lot of stuff at half speed, because they didn't have MIDI technology, for example, and they had to take whatever tools they had and try and make something good out of it with the limitations.
So on a song on your new CD, say, for example, Day Tripper, where there's a lot going on and it's very upbeat, and much faster than the opening track. How many different sounds did you create on the Moog synthesizer for that particular track?
Oh, probably about 25 separate tracks, I'm thinking, with the synthesizer on it. It kind of depends on the song, really. Some had less, some had more. The one that really has a lot is the very last track The Storm Over Beethoven, which is a Beethoven piece. And that has something like 35 separate tracks on it. And that was a huge project. But basically, I don't really do it for the sake of trying to impress people with how many tracks there are. It's just whatever it takes to get the sound. And so if it takes a lot of tracks to get the sound I'm looking for, then I'll do it. If it only takes two or three tracks, that's fine too, you know. Some of the songs will have acoustic guitar backing or maybe even organ backing or something like that. And it wasn't necessary to do, like, you know, tons and tons of tracks. So it kind of depends on what the song calls for in terms of how I visualize the arrangement for the tune.
Well, let's take a listen to Day Tripper, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Here is Day Tripper from the new CD, Moogtastic, by our guest, Dana Countryman.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you are just tuning in, this is a special edition of the Kitsch Niche. We are interviewing Dana Countryman, Moog impresario. And what I want to do right now, while we're in the middle of the interview, I want to give away one of Dana Countryman's brand new CDs, Moogtastic, Moog Music by Dana Countryman for the 24th Century on Oglio Records. I know I'm pronouncing it wrong. Oleo, I think, is how you pronounce it. But whatever. It's a silent G. What are you going to do? I'm an American. We pronounce everything. It's available through iTunes. Also, you can go to danacountryman.com. But I'm going to give away one copy right now to a lucky listener. By the way, if you are listening, you got to do two things right now. A, get into the luxuriamusic.com chat room if you want to chat about the interview. And having a very interesting chat going on in the chat room right now. Also, you want to immediately get onto Facebook and get onto the Strike Kitchnich page. Strike Kitchnich. Three words. Strike Kitchnich. Because in order to answer this question, you're going to message me on my Facebook page. The very first correct message that I receive will receive a brand new copy of Moogtastic by Dana Countryman. Here is the question. Now, these questions are a little tough, but in the age of technology, you know, if you Google it, it should take you 2 seconds to get the answer. And cheating is good, so I encourage it. Here is the trivia question for the very first copy of Moogtastic. Are you ready? Strike Kitchnich. That is my Facebook page. While you're there, why don't you become a friend of the show as well? What non-video arcade game features electronics manufactured by Moog Music? Again, the question is, what non-video arcade game features... Sorry, what non-video arcade game features electronics manufactured by Moog Music? The first message, not post on my wall. It actually has to be a message to me on Strike Kitchnich. That's my Facebook page. Will receive a copy of Moogtastic. This offer is not available to members of the Kitchnich family, which includes me only. Good luck, everyone. Here now, part two of my interview with Dana Countryman.
So I love that you end the song with references to all the other Beatles songs. Here's what I picked out, and you tell me if I'm missing any. I heard Tomorrow Never Knows, Within Without You, Paperback Writer, and She Said, She Said. Am I missing anything?
Yep.
What else is there?
Well, there's a reference to Helter Skelter. You got to listen carefully for it. Let me think. Hey, you got the main. Well, I know there's one, and that is You Can't Do That.
How long did it take you to perfect that sound?
Boy, you know, this was a long, long project. I started it about 8 years ago, to be honest. In fact, I think that Lovesick Martian Boy tune was the first one that I did. But I got distracted. There were complete albums with Jean-Jacques, and we did a lot of touring. And then I took a summer off and worked with my wife on a musical where I was the musical director for that. And so there were a lot of distractions along the way. But to kind of answer your question, I was a huge fan, I still am, of all those old Moog albums. And not just by Jean-Jacques Perret, but by Gil Trythall and all the other guys that put out synthesizer albums in the late 60s and the early 70s. And I've got them. I've got a huge record collection. And I would search them out on eBay and go through used record stores and looking for the gems, you know. And one of the reasons I put Day Tripper on there was because it seemed to me that a lot of these synthesizer Moog albums always had one or two Beatles songs on it. And I thought, well, I'm a huge Beatles fan. And I thought, well, that's really cool. And I have to kind of pay tribute to that mentality by picking a Beatles song and doing a Moog synthesizer cover of it. And so that's specifically why I did Day Tripper. I just thought it would be fun to do Day Tripper. And I don't think it's one of the Beatles' best songs they ever wrote either. It just seemed like it would be a really fun one to do with the Moog. And it was, actually. And I brought in my drummer, friend Rick. He played awesome drums on that. And had another guest star on the album as well.
Which was Morgan Fisher, who did it?
Yeah.
From
yeah.
Mott
the Hoople, exactly. And he came to my studio to see my Ondulene. And I had never met him before. I think he emailed me, and he heard I had one. And he's an instrument collector. And he lives in Japan, actually, somewhere around Tokyo. So he was just in town to do some sightseeing or something like that. And we just sort of hit it off. And I asked him, you know, would you be willing to play on my upcoming album? And he said that he'd love to. So I never was a huge Mott the Hoople fan, but I think it's really cool that the organ player is really into synthesizers, and he's got all these vintage instruments in his own studio. Now he has two Ondulenes, by the way.
Ah, so you also have Skip Heller performing on the CD, who, of course, our listeners know because he's done a few shows on Luxuria Music, and Vinnie Bell is on the CD. How did you come to work with Vinnie Bell?
Well, you know, I interviewed Vinnie for the book that I'm writing on Jean-Jacques' life, and I'm almost done now with it. It should be out by Thanksgiving. So I've been working on this biography, which is another thing that delayed me from getting this album done, off and on for 5 years. So Vinny was an important part of Jean-Jacques Records because he played on all those Vanguard albums, and he's an incredible musician. I actually was a fan of his from his solo albums too, things like the Love Theme from Airport and his crazy water sound and all the other guitar sounds that he was able to basically invented. So I was a fan of his, and I interviewed him on the phone, and we just sort of hit it off. I can't really explain it. It's only happened to me a couple times where I've interviewed somebody and we just kind of clicked and stayed in touch, and we became great friends. I ended up going to stay with him and his wife for a week in New Jersey, and I asked him if when I come out there, if it would be fantastic if we could record together, if I could take him into a studio. And he said he would be very happy to do that. So I actually wrote this tune called Vinny's Theme specifically for that trip. And we went into the recording studio in Inglewood, New Jersey. It's called Bennett Studios. It's owned by Tony Bennett's son. And so we went into the studio together, and Vinny played fantastically. He played the electric sitar, which is another instrument he invented. And it was a big thrill for me to get to work with Vinny. And that track, we did that, I think, in 2004. So it's just now seeing the light of day. I've been sitting on it for a long time. But Vinny's a very, very sweet guy, very super talented, but also a very warm person. And as a matter of fact, I need to call him tonight after this conversation.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Vinny's Theme. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Dana Countryman. He has a new CD out entitled Moogtastic on Oglio Records. And this is Vinny's Theme featuring guitarist Vinny Bell.
ladies and gentlemen. You are tuned to the Kitchnitch on Luxuria Music, your home for all interesting things, whatever the heck that means. My name is Strike. Tonight, the first hour of our show is an interview with Dana Countryman, whose brand new CD, Moogtastic, is the music that you've been hearing in the background, as well as the man being interviewed. Well, we didn't have any winners for our first trivia question. We had a lot of people come up with arcade games that featured music performed on the Moog, Dragon's Lair, and Pango, but I was actually looking for a non-video arcade game featuring electronics in the game itself, manufactured by Moog Music Corporation. The answer, which I will tell you right now, I just got to double check. I don't have anybody waiting for me. Nope. The answer was Chex Hockey. Chex Hockey was the answer to that one. Well, no worries. Here is another chance to get yourself a copy of the brand new Moogtastic CD that we just heard from a second ago. Go to my Facebook page, Strike Kitchnitch. It's all three words, Strike Kitchnitch, and message me your answer. Don't post it on my wall. You got to message me the answer. Here is another chance. Different question. What is Max Brand's synthesizer also known as? What is Max Brand's synthesizer also known as? Go to my Facebook page, Strike Kitchnitch. Get me the answer. The first correct answer is going to win a copy of the brand new Moogtastic CD on Olio Records by Dana Countryman, available on iTunes as well as danacountryman.com. Also, while you're there, make sure you friend the Kitchnitch. We're looking for friends of the show always, folks. And also get into the chat room here on luxuriamusic.com. We're having some very interesting chat if you're listening to the show live, or even if you're downloading the podcast from our podcast page, which you can, including last week's birthday special with a very crazy special with a friend of the show, Ron Sears. So let's get back into the interview with Dana Countryman, and I will be back in about 10 minutes to let you know if anybody won that CD, and we'll give you another chance to win. I got a couple copies we're giving away tonight. Here you go. More of the interview.
I love that water sound that he gets when he hits. He's hitting near the pickup of the guitar. How did he actually make that sound?
Well, you know, he keeps it really secret. I was with him in the studio, and he has this kind of mysterious box. It's kind of like Joe Meek and all his mysterious effects. And I said, how do you do this, Vinny? How do you get it? And he goes, Dana, no offense, but I can't tell you. And he's sworn, I don't think anybody knows how he does it. In fact, he told me that Les Paul went to his grave begging Vinny, how did you get the water sound? And so, I don't know, he's just a very ingenious guy. He would go down to his workshop in the evenings when he wasn't recording and invent these things. And he's been using that sound since the mid-60s. So I don't know how he does it, and I hope it's not lost to time. But I hope that he'll will it to the Smithsonian or something.
That's great. I would like to talk just a little bit about your relationship with Jean-Jacques Perry. And I understand that you began corresponding with him in the mid-90s. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it was 1994. When I first wrote to him, I had just gotten my copy of The Incredibly Strange Music book, which I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with. And in the back of that article, Jean-Jacques had put his address. And I thought that was super cool because, first of all, I had never really read any interviews with Jean-Jacques Perret, even though I'd had his records all those years before. And I'd never seen any pictures except the one with him and Gershon on the back of The In Sound From Way Out. So I was really fascinated with that that book, and I really bought the book because of the Jean-Jacques Perret article that was in there.
So up to that point, had he gone through a period where he separated himself from that period of his life where he did all of the Moog music, much like Dick Hyman had sort of walked away from that period of his life and sort of turned to serious jazz and wasn't all enthusiastic about revisiting it? Or was he active with that sound, or was he happy to come back to it? What exactly did he feel? Because it was almost a 20-year period between the time that he recorded a new record with the Moog, is that correct?
I think it was more than 20 years that he'd waited to record again. And it's a little different than Dick Hyman, who, by the way, I'm kind of friendly with, too. And we're not super great friends, but we've had some great conversations. So the thing is that Jean-Jacques wasn't trying to distance himself from the synthesizer things. He just thought everybody had forgotten about him. And he lived in France, in Paris. He really was not very successful once he went back to France from America after he'd got albums. And for a while, he was a music director at a ballet company and worked for a radio station and, did some solo piano things where he'd play in a restaurant. But really, you would never know that this guy was this brilliant, pioneer of synthesizer music. So he kind of retired. I think it was 1993. And basically thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to be a fisherman and go outside and sit on a park bench and fish for fun and, forget about my career. And then that Incredibly Strange Music book kind of reopened up everybody's interest. And all of a sudden, he was getting requests to do lectures and concerts and to record. He did that album with David Shazam, Eclectronics. And he was, delighted because he thought he was totally forgotten. And all of a sudden, he was being revered. And I talk about this in the book. It was kind of his blue period where he was really kind of depressed and his parents had passed away. And then out of the blue, all these young people were fascinated with him and wanted to interview him and record with him. So, that was a really happy time for Jean-Jacques. And he's still kind of basking in that glow, because he's still getting asked to record with people. And he just put out a new album with this guy, Cosmic, I can't think of his name. My mind's going blank. Anyway.
You recorded two albums with him. In 2005, it was Happy Electro Pop Music Machine. And then again in 2008, you released Destination Space. What was it like recording with the master? Did he teach you all of his secrets? Was he very generous in terms of sort of opening your eyes to parts things about the Moog that you've never really experienced before? Describe that process.
Yeah, he was definitely very generous. And the first thing he did, even before we recorded, was he gave me access. Well, I had told him that when I was 16 or 17, I had written a letter to Vanguard Records, Jean-Jacques Perret in care of Vanguard Records. And I said, I would just love to have one of your loops. If you have any old pieces of tape laying around, that would be so cool. I'd love to take a look at this and see how you did it. And I never got a response. Well, I didn't know that he had moved to France, back to France, and basically he never got my letter. So all these years later, when we became, at first, kind of casual friends, I asked him, do you have any old pieces of tape? And he said, well, I'll do better than that. I'll just send you all my sounds. So he very generously sent me a CD with all of his original samples that he recorded way back in the early 60s. And we're talking back as early as 1962, when he started making all these little weird sounds that you hear in his loops, the things that go, all these little bits and pieces were recorded on mono tape starting back as early as 1962, probably 62 through 68 or something like that. And they were all very well transferred into a digital format. And so, he's very open-minded about sharing how he did this, and he would explain to me some of the techniques that he used and some of the tricks. And some of the things he did were brilliantly ingenious, very clever.
You want to tell us one, or is that a trade secret as well?
No. Let me try and think of a good example. There's one tune, I can't think of the tune, on the In Sound from Way Out, where the notes start just a shade after the beat. And it's the one that goes, that thing. And which is taken from a classical piece. And the way he did it was he actually went into the tape and spliced in little pieces of white leader after the note started. So when you heard the note come by, it would be just behind the beat. So I thought he just played it that way on the original recording. But no, he went to the trouble to actually go in and make splices in front of every single note just to get that effect. So this is a guy that was incredibly patient. He had the patience of a watchmaker, really, to do a lot of the stuff that he did.
That's incredible. And when you think about the technology of today and how easy it is to do that, that he had to, you know, go actually by hand splicing every single note. That must have been a Herculean effort.
Absolutely. And he did other things. The one that I think is the most brilliant piece is, in my opinion, is the piece Gossip Perpetuo. And where you took a male singer and a female singer into the studio and recorded them going bop, 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 and then cut up all those notes into individual little pieces and spliced them together end to end, brought in a bunch of session players, had them play along with it. I mean, it sounds like a samba, Brazilian samba for robots, you know? And the first time I heard that thing, I just kind of fell on the floor laughing. And amazingly, he told me that when they first started recording that, all the session musicians burst out laughing because it was so unusual and so funny and so unlike anything else that all these seasoned session cats had ever played on. And it was a huge thrill, let me tell you, to work with Jean-Jacques because he was an early idol of mine. And I never dreamed in a million years when I was lugging those albums to my French class when I was a teenager that all these years later I would get to be sitting in a studio with him and sitting side by side and, like you said, learning from the master. It was a great thrill, and I'll never forget it.
Do you have a favorite track of Jean-Jacques Perret?
My favorite song of Jean-Jacques Perret is one that most people would probably never think of. It's called Country Rock Polka, and it's on the Moog Indigo album, the very last album Jean-Jacques did before he moved back to France. It is so incredibly happy. It's like the happiest piece of music I think I've ever heard in my life. And I've told my wife, if I ever, well, someday I will die, and if I die before you, honey, I want this song played at my funeral because it is so darn happy. I don't want people to be sad and depressed. I want them to be snickering and smiling, and that's what I do. I've never gotten tired of that song. I've played it hundreds of times.
Let's just listen to that song right now, and then we'll be back to continue our interview with Dana Countryman, who has a brand new CD out, Moog-tastic, on Oglio Records. We'll be right back.
Folks, if you're just tuning in, you are listening to an interview I did with Dana Countryman, whose brand new CD, Moogtastic, is out and available on Olio Records. You can get that on iTunes. Moogtastic is how you spell it. Moogtastic is how you pronounce it. Also, you can go to DanaCountryman.com. Time now for another trivia question. We're giving away copies of this brand new CD. And I just want to mention real quick, thank you to everybody who answered correctly to the last question. What is Max Brand's synthesizer also known as? It's called the Moogtonium. And congratulations to Lewis Siegel from California, who won himself a copy of the brand new Moogtastic CD on Olio Records. He'll be getting that in a few days. So, Lewis, you cannot answer this question. So you're out of the game. But anybody else, all you got to do is go to my Facebook page, which is Strike Kitchnich, and you need to message me your answer. Don't post it on my wall. Actually, message me, Strike Kitchnich, and the first correct answer that I receive in order will receive a copy of the brand new Moogtastic CD. Also, please do not say the answer in the chat room, because that's kind of... Well, the last person who did that actually lost out because someone was quicker than him to get to the Facebook page. So you don't want to trip on your own self getting there. Here is the next question. The first correct answer will win a copy of the brand new Moogtastic CD. What, and this is a stupid, stupid question, but I'm running out of good ones. What is the connection between Jellyfish and the Moog synthesizer? What is the connection between Jellyfish and the Moog synthesizer? Get onto my Facebook page, Strike Kitchnich. Three words, Strike Kitchnich. Message me your answer, and you will win a copy, if you're first, of the new Moogtastic CD. Also, why don't you become a friend of the Kitchnich while you're there? Here is the next segment of my interview with Dana Countryman.
So, Dana, I would like to talk to you for a few minutes about the magazine that you created and edited for a number of years, Cool and Strange Music magazine. To me, this was probably one of the happiest periods of my life, waiting to get this magazine it was bi-monthly, is that? I can't remember now.
It came out quarterly.
Quarterly.
So every 3 months.
This was the greatest magazine of all time, in my opinion, and still is.
Wow.
Because there had been nothing like it before, and really there's been nothing like it since. There are websites that you can go to for, you know, articles here and there, but this was really kind of the Bible to all us record collectors who are really interested in sounds and music and personalities that were out of the mainstream and really different from anything else. I've just grabbed a copy here by random. This is the issue number 16 from I believe it was June or May of 2000. And on the cover it's Spike Jones. There's an article on Esquivel, Screaming Lord Sutch, Robert Drasnin, Burt Camford, High School Band Records. I mean, you know, this was, it was almost like I could finally justify being a nerd. really...
Well, you know, that's how we all felt when the Incredibly Strange Music book came out. My first thought was, I can't believe there's other people that actually like this stuff. Because I was buying records just for the wacky covers. And I remember I bought that I can't think of the name of it now. The Raymond Scott album, just for the cover. And I didn't really know Raymond Scott's music, and I played what was in the record, on the record, and I went like, whoa, this is great on the inside too, you know? So that was really my first reaction to those books, and I couldn't believe there were other collectors out there. And then my second thought was, well, I guess these guys are probably going to put out a magazine next. And I kept waiting, and I think I waited 2 years, or 3 years, and in 1996... I decided, well, no one else is doing it. I don't know anything about the magazine business, but I would like to learn, and I would like to do this kind of a magazine. So my parents had bought me a computer 1993, it was a Mac, and I got some software. A buddy and I chipped in together, and we bought some graphic design software and Photoshop, and I really didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea how many people would actually buy such a magazine. I knew a couple of my record collector friends probably would. I remember this one guy said, well, you know, Dana, I think maybe there'll be like 200 people, maybe maximum, that would probably be interested in a magazine like what you're trying to do. So one of the first things I did was I got on the internet, and I got onto the Exotica Music News Group, and I said, I'm starting a kind of unusual record collecting magazine called Cool and Strange Music, and if you send me your address, I will send you the first copy for free. And I had about 500 people email me with their addresses. So that was how it started. And I remember I only had 3 ads in the very first issue. I definitely lost money on the first issue. By about the third issue, I was starting to get ads from Capitol Records and Rhino Records and some of the bigger players. So I knew I was kind of on to something.
That was sort of the golden period, the golden age of Incredibly Strange Music, was that period from around 1994 to about 2001, 2002. Tell us about some of the contributors to the magazine. I know that you had Skip Heller writing articles, Brother Cleave, Michael David Toth, who we know as Tothar, who also has a show here on Luxuria Music. How did you collect these people?
Well, you know, once people found out I was doing this magazine, they kind of contacted me. And I remember Skip Heller was one of those people. Also, Wayno, the artist that did all the covers, he contacted me very early on, I think before the second issue came out, because he illustrated in the second issue on the cover. And then in the very first issue, I was stupid and didn't put his illustration on the front. I put it on the inside. But Wayno was involved with every single issue. And I did 28 issues over the course of 7 years. But yeah, they would search me out, and people would say, hey, can I write an article about, you know, Chano or whoever, Julie London? And if it was a good idea, I'd go, yeah, go for it. And I didn't really know their style or if they were capable writers or not. I just kind of did it on a leap of faith. And I tell you, 9 times out of 10, even more than that, everybody turned out to be great writers. They had a passion for the subject. Occasionally somebody would suggest something that I just really wasn't into, and I would say, you know, it's really not appropriate for this kind of magazine. But then they'd come up with another idea that I'd go, piece on whoever the next artist was, Martin Denny. And so then that would happen. So I never really got in a situation where I was desperate for articles, because so many people were writing me out of the blue. And sometimes they would only write one article and never really offer to do one again. But they had that one thing, that one passion for that one artist, and they wrote really well. And a lot of times we were able to find the artist and do exclusive interviews with them. And there were a few times we tried to get exclusive interviews, and the artists were so slippery that we finally gave up. I remember Mort Garson was one of them, and we finally wrote an article without him being involved in it. But 9 times out of 10, we were able to actually, either through their record company or their publicist or manager, get to the person. And that was always super fun for me. Like, we had Julius Wechter that we interviewed, and I can't even think off the top of my head. I need some magazines around here to look at. But
do you have a favorite article that sort of leaps to mind from the series?
One of my favorites is the Mel Blanc article. I love the Mel Blanc issue. I love the graphics. I love what Wayno did on the cover. The articles on the inside. That's one that sticks out in my mind. We did so many, though. We did the Firesign Theater. Just it really ran the gamut, you know. And the other thing was that record companies just started sending me promo CDs. Like, I'd come home and there'd be a huge stack of bubble wrap mailers, and I'd take a big armload downstairs to my office in the basement of my house. It was like Christmas every day, basically. I had more CDs than could possibly be reviewed in the magazine. But Yeah, I got to say that it was a great, great experience. I made so many really excellent friends that are still friends to this day. And I still go places where I meet people who had written for the magazine or they were just fans of the magazine. People contact me on Facebook, and a lot of times I don't know who they are, and I write them. I say, just remind me of how I know you again. And I got one yesterday, and he said, oh, I was a fan of the magazine. Oh, okay, cool, cool.
So are,
yeah,
let's be friends. Back issues available, or is that a thing of the past?
No, I kept all the back issues that I had. And I do sell them on my website, danacountryman.com. Some of the back issues are not available anymore, but the ones that are, people can definitely purchase. And like that, you can probably get them cheaper from me than you can off eBay. These things turn up on eBay all the time, and sometimes I'm amazed by the prices that people are asking for them. And that's a really big compliment, I gotta say, that people like the magazine. By the way, thank you for the compliment. I really do appreciate, you know, hearing nice things about it. I put my heart and soul into that magazine. And for 7 years, I didn't work on any of my own music. And I totally devoted myself to writing about, you know, indirectly writing about other people's music and definitely presenting other people's music.
It's a magazine I'm sure the listeners of Luxury Music would love. So everybody for listening should check that out. I do have a couple more questions before and this is something I like to ask people when I interview them. What was the first strange record that you ever bought that you would consider weird or unusual that perhaps, you know, other people maybe not had not been familiar with up to that point?
Well, I don't know how strange it is, but I remember one of the first artists I was really thrilled with was Spike Jonze. And I didn't discover him until I was about 15 or 16 years old, really right around the same time I discovered Jean-Jacques. And I was just, you know, I couldn't believe that there was this music out there. It was so goofy and happy and incredibly silly, but really well done. And that was one of my really early influences. And then it turns out that that was one of Jean-Jacques, too. We had that in common, that, you know, that he kind of did his electronic music based on what Jean-Jacques had, and what Spike Jonze had meant to him. But really the first album I remember buying where I bought it specifically because of the cover, and you might have to help me with the title on this, but it was the Dinner Music for a Pack of Hungry Cannibals. And that was the record that has the cover with the lady sitting in the big pot with the... she's got other models around her with spears, and I thought, well, this is a really weird cover. I got to buy this. I got it at a thrift store for like a dollar, you know.
That's the thing I love, is that hearing about all these records that everybody, they always say, oh, yeah, I found this in a thrift store. And today they're like $100, $200 records. Everybody found for 50.
Exactly.
And I also love that record companies weren't very interested in being politically correct back then, and they could really hog wild.
They had the freedom to do whatever they wanted to. You know, on the very first cover of the magazine, we had an Anna Russell cover where she's in the pot,
yes,
and all these African guys with spears, you know, pointing them menacingly at her. I mean, you couldn't get away with that now. But it was all done in a spirit of fun. I really don't think they were trying to be racist back in those days, and at least not in that particular cover.
Right.
But